Chapter 29. Not being favored by chance in getting acquainted with Dede Mason, Daylight's interest in her slowly waned. This was but natural, for he was plunged deep in hazardous operations, and the fascinations of the game, and the magnitude of it accounted for all the energy that even his magnificent organism could generate. Such was his absorption, that the pretty stenographer slowly and imperceptibly faded from the forefront of his consciousness. Thus, the first faint spur, in the best sense, of his need for woman ceased to prod. So far as Dede Mason was concerned, he possessed no more than a complacent feeling of satisfaction in that he had a very nice stenographer. And, completely to put the quietus on any last lingering hopes he might have had of her, he was in the thick of his spectacular and intensely bitter fight with the Coastwise Steam Navigation Company and the Hawaiian, Nicaraguan, and Pacific Mexican Steamship Company. He stirred up a bigger muss than he had anticipated, and even he was astounded at the wide ramifications of the struggle, and at the unexpected and incongruous interests that were drawn into it. Every newspaper in San Francisco turned upon him. It was true, one or two of them at first intimated that they were open to subsidization, but Daylight's judgment was that the situation did not warrant such expenditure. Up to this time the press had been amusingly tolerant and good-naturedly sensational about him, but now he was to learn what virulent scrupulousness an antagonized press was capable of. Every episode of his life was resurrected to serve as foundations for malicious fabrications. Daylight was frankly amazed at the new interpretation put upon all he had accomplished and the deeds he had done. From an Alaskan hero he was metamorphosed into an Alaskan bully, liar, desperado, and all-around ad man. Not content with this, lies upon lies, out of whole cloth, were manufactured about him. He never replied, though once he went to the extent of disburdening his mind to half a dozen reporters. "Oh, you're damnedest," he told them. "Burning Daylight's bucked bigger things than your dirty, lying sheets. And I don't blame you, boys, that is, not much. You can't help it. You've got to live. There's a mighty lot of women in this world that make their living in similar fashion to yours, because they're not able to do anything better. Somebody's got to do the dirty work, and it might as well be you. You're paid for it, and you ain't got the backbone to rustle cleaner jobs." The socialist press of the city jubilantly exploited this utterance, scattering it broadcast over San Francisco in tens of thousands of paper dodgers. And the journalists, stung to the quick, retaliated with the only means in their power, printer's ink abuse. The attack became bitterer than ever. The whole affair sank to the deeper deeps of rancor and savageness. The poor woman who had killed herself was dragged out of her grave, and paraded on thousands of reams of paper as a martyr, and a victim to Daylight's ferocious brutality. Staid, statistical articles were published, proving that he had made his start by robbing poor miners of their claims, and that the capstone to his fortune had been put in place by his treacherous violation of faith with the Guggenheimers in the deal on offer. And there were editorials written in which he was called an enemy of society, possessed of the manners and culture of a caveman, a fomenter of wasteful business troubles, the destroyer of the city's prosperity in commerce and trade, an anarchist of dire menace. And one editorial gravely recommended that hanging would be a lesson to him and his ilk, and concluded with the fervent hope that someday his big motor car would smash up, and smash him with it. He was like a big bear raiding a beehive, and, regardless of the stings, he obstinately persisted in pawing for the honey. He gritted his teeth and struck back. Beginning with a raid on two steamship companies, it developed into a pitched battle with a city, a state, and a continental coastline. Very well, they wanted fight, and they would get it. It was what he wanted, and he felt justified in having come down from the Klondike, for here he was gambling at a bigger table than ever the Yukon had supplied. allied with him, on a splendid salary, with princely pickings thrown in, was a lawyer, Larry Egan, a young Irishman with a reputation to make, and whose peculiar genius had been unrecognized until daylight picked up with him. Egan had Celtic imagination and daring, and to such degree, that daylight's cooler head was necessary as a check on his wilder visions. Egan's was a Napoleonic legal mind, without balance, and it was just this balance that daylight supplied. Alone, the Irishman was doomed to failure, but directed by daylight, he was on the high road to fortune and recognition. Also, he was possessed of no more personal or civic conscience than Napoleon. It was Egan who guided daylight through the intricacies of modern politics, labor organization, and commercial and corporation law. It was Egan, prolific of resource and suggestion, who opened daylight's eyes to undreamed possibilities in 20th century warfare, and it was daylight, rejecting, accepting, and elaborating, who planned the campaigns and prosecuted them. With the Pacific coast from Puget Sound to Panama, buzzing and humming, and with San Francisco furiously about his ears, the two big steamship companies had all the appearance of winning. It looked as if Burning Daylight was being beaten slowly to his knees. And then he struck at the steamship companies, at San Francisco, at the whole Pacific coast. It was not much of a blow at first. A Christian Endeavor convention being held in San Francisco, a row was started by Express Drivers Union No. 927 over the handling of a small heap of baggage at the ferry building. A few heads were broken, a score of arrests made, and the baggage was delivered. No one would have guessed that behind this petty wrangle was the fine Irish hand of Egan, made potent by the Klondike gold of Burning Daylight. It was an insignificant affair at best, or so it seemed. But the Teamsters Union took up the quarrel, backed by the whole Waterfront Federation. Step by step, the strike became involved. A refusal of cooks and waiters to serve scab Teamsters or Teamsters employers brought out the cooks and waiters. The butchers and meat cutters refused to handle meat destined for unfair restaurants. The combined employers' associations put up a solid front, and found facing them the 40,000 organized laborers of San Francisco. The restaurant bakers and the bakery wagon drivers struck, followed by the milkers, milk drivers, and chicken pickers. The building trades asserted its position in unambiguous terms, and all San Francisco was in turmoil. But still, it was only San Francisco. Egan's intrigues were masterly, and Daylight's campaign steadily developed. The powerful fighting organization known as the Pacific Slope Seamen's Union refused to work vessels the cargoes, of which were to be handled by scab longshoremen and freight handlers. The union presented its ultimatum, and then called a strike. This had been Daylight's objective all the time. Every incoming coastwise vessel was boarded by the union officials and its crew sent ashore. And with the seamen went the firemen, the engineers, and the sea cooks and waiters. Daily the number of idle steamers increased. It was impossible to get scab crews, for the men of the Seamen's Union were fighters trained in the hard school of the sea, and when they went out it meant blood and death to scabs. This phase of the strike spread up and down the entire Pacific coast, until all the ports were filled with idle ships, and sea transportation was at a standstill. The days and weeks dragged out, and the strike held. The Coastwise Steam Navigation Company, and the Hawaiian, Nicaraguan, and Pacific Mexican Steamship Company were tied up completely. The expenses of combating the strike were tremendous, and they were earning nothing, while daily the situation went from bad to worse, until peace at any price became the cry. And still there was no peace, until Daylight and his allies played out their hand, raked in the winnings, and allowed a goodly portion of a continent to resume business. It was noted, in following years, that several leaders of workmen built themselves houses and blocks of renting flats, and took trips to the old countries, while, more immediately, other leaders and our courses came to political preferment and the control of the municipal government and the municipal monies. In fact, San Francisco's boss-ridden condition was due in greater degree to Daylight's wide-spreading battle than even San Francisco ever dreamed. For the part he had played, the details of which were practically all rumor and guesswork, quickly leaked out, and in consequence he became a much execrated and well-hated man. Nor had Daylight himself dreamed that his raid on the steamship companies would have grown to such colossal proportions. But he had got what he was after. He had played an exciting hand and won, beating the steamship companies down into the dust, and mercilessly robbing the stockholders by perfectly legal methods, before he let go. Of course, in addition to the large sums of money he had paid over, his allies had rewarded themselves by gobbling the advantages which later enabled them to loot the city. His alliance with a gang of cutthroats had brought about a lot of cutthroating. But his conscience suffered no twinges. He remembered what he had once heard an old preacher utter, namely, that they who rose by the sword perished by the sword. One took his chances when he played with cutting throats, and his, Daylight's, throat was still intact. That was it. And he had won. It was all gamble and war between the strong men. The fools did not count. They were always getting hurt, and that they always had been getting hurt was the conclusion he drew from what little he knew of history. San Francisco had wanted war, and he had given it war. It was the game. All the big fellows did the same, and they did much worse too. "Don't talk to me about morality and civic duty," he replied to a persistent interviewer. "If you quit your job tomorrow and went to work on another paper, you would write just what you were told to write. It's morality and civic duty now with you. On the new job it would be backing up a thieving railroad with. Morality and civic duty, I suppose. Your price, my son, is just about 30 per week. That's what you sell for. But your paper would sell for a bit more. Pay its price today, and it would shift its present rotten policy to some other rotten policy, but it would never let up on morality and civic duty. And all because a sucker is born every minute. So long as the people stand for it, they'll get it good and plenty, my son. And the shareholders and business interests might as well shut up squawking about how much they've been hurt. You never hear Airy squeal out of them when they've got the other fellow down and are gouging him. This is the time they got gouged, and that's all there is to it. Talk about mollycoddles. Son, those same fellows would steal crusts from starving men and pull gold fillings from the mouths of corpses, yep, and squawk like Sam Scratch if some blamed corpse hit back. They're all tarred with the same brush, little and big. Look at your sugar trust with all its millions stealing water like a common thief from New York City, and short weighing the government on its phony scales. Morality and civic duty. Son, forget it." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.